If you have a phone, you might want to turn it off so it does not distract us through the class. Who wants to, is willing, which is the same thing, and able, to do a quick summary for those of us who have been gone? No. Quick summary of Exodus. Exodus 1 through 14. What happens? Chapter 1. Chapter 2. Chapter 3, 4, God calls Moses. Chapter 5, Moses goes back and talks to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says no. Chapter 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, plagues and delivery. Okay, last week we talked about... Yes. Yes. Right. That's through the through Egypt, through the plagues. Two classes ago that I taught, we talked about Egypt and the plagues with regard to Egypt and that perspective. Last week we talked a little bit about Israel. This week I want to talk about some more about Israel, and we're going to get out of the plagues and out of the Exodus into hopefully all the way to Mount Sinai today. Okay, so... God, in chapter 12, delivers the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In chapter 13, he says, look, I'm taking your firstborn because I didn't take your firstborn. And then, the end of chapter 13, God starts leading them again, starts leading Israel. Verse 17, when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by the way of the land of Philistines, even though it was near. For God said, the people might change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. Hence, God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the Red Sea. And the sons of Israel went up in martial array from the land of Egypt. Finally, I have remembered to connect my internet to my computer on a Thursday and get a good map. So, this is about the best map that I can find. Okay, first of all, you see this little dotted line there, goes up there? That's the road to the Philistines, okay? So he doesn't send them up there. Now, what's odd about that? That's where they're going, right? So he doesn't send them where they're going. Instead, he sends them down this direction. Many people think it's right there because he backs them into a corner. That's chapter 14. He puts them in this place where it's either fight the Egyptians or cross the Red Sea. There is no other way to go. Is it in this little... peninsula, like in the land? We don't know for sure, but that's the kind of picture that conjures up the image here. So, chapter 14, I'm skipping a little bit. Verse 19 of chapter 13, Moses took the bones of Joseph. Remember, Joseph said, take me home. So this is him fulfilling that. Verse 20, they set out from Succoth and camped at Etham on the edge of the wilderness. The Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud by day to lead them on the way, and a pillar of fire by night to give them light, that they may travel by day and night. What we have here is GPS, God's positioning service. He's telling them all the time where they are. And what you get out of this is, although they cannot see God, what do they know? God is with them. So anything that's happening while that cloud or that fire is right there, they really don't have any excuse, even if that cloud and fire weren't there, but especially with that cloud and fire, if they start doubting or whatever, they really don't have an excuse. So he's there showing them how to go. Chapter 14, verse 2, tell the sons of Israel to turn back and camp before Perioth, between Migdol and the sea. You shall camp in front of Baal Zephon, opposite it, by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly in the land. By the way, that's why I have that jiggity-jaggity arrow there, because it seems that they're wandering aimlessly. That means they're not going in a direct line. So, it seems they're wandering aimlessly in the land. Thus the wilderness has shut them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will chase after them. And we know the story, because we've read it now 16 times this month. Okay. Pharaoh comes down after them, and when he draws near, chapter 14, verse 10, as Pharaoh drew near, The sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them, and they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not the word which we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, 'Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians'? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." Moses sees that, and he has learned something from God in these 10 plagues. And he says, "I'm going to go with God on this one." He says to them, "Do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today." They're not going to have to do a thing except cross the Red Sea. They crossed the Red Sea, verse 30 of chapter 14. "Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians. And Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power of the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses." And they have been converted here, and we see that in chapter 15. They're saying, "Oh yes, this is our God. Look at our great God, and he is ours." And thank God that they will never, ever again stumble in their faith. Right. Chapter 15, the very same chapter where they have just cried out and said, "Oh yes, he's our God." They run out of water. And verse 24, they grumbled at Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Then he cried out to the Lord, and he miraculously provides more water. Chapter 16, verse 2, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness because they didn't have food. Chapter 17, verse 2, therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." Again and again and again we see Israel is falling. What we have here is an illustration of the seed that falls on the rocky soil. They hear the word. They are delivered. Oh yes, they accept it with joy. And then persecution and trouble arises from being committed to the word. And because of this hardship, they fall away. This is exactly what happens here. They accept, "Oh yes, we want God. We've got God." But as soon as some hardship comes up, over and over and over, they fall down. A couple relevant thoughts. Israel begged for delivery but didn't like God's plan. Sound familiar? Note well, Israel was saved by baptism. What am I talking about? I'm really putting together two passages, or one primarily. Did anybody have any idea what I'm talking about? Brian.
Is it the same way that Noah was saved through baptism?
Yes. And Paul himself makes the point. Okay, first of all, notice, when was Israel actually saved? When they had gone through the dry riverbed. That's chapter 14. They walked through the dry riverbed. Verse 30, the Lord saved Israel that day. Okay, we didn't read the part where they walked through the dry riverbed, but you've read it before, I assume. Okay, he saved them that day. Interesting, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, what does Paul call when they walked through the riverbed? 1 Corinthians 10? Well, it says, yeah. 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1, "I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud, and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea." So here we have Paul calling what happened back there in Exodus 14 a baptism, which is interesting because it wasn't anything like a baptism. Well, it was like a baptism because they're surrounded by water. But the analogy that he makes actually relies on New Testament baptism to make any sense whatsoever. Because they're baptized in the New Testament. They're actually immersed in the water. He assumes that to make the point that he makes about Moses, which I find interesting. So Israel was saved by baptism. That's where I get that. Paul doesn't actually say that he's saved by baptism. God doesn't either. They were saved that day. Paul calls it baptism. Now, Christians are saved by baptism. Can you think of a passage where it says, baptism now saves you? 1 Peter 3:21. Right. We could name these, list these again and again and again. Some random thoughts. What's new, right? Okay. Expect to be misunderstood. When God said, turn around and start going that way, Pharaoh will think they're wandering aimlessly in the land. Were they? God was telling them everywhere to go. That was not aimless, but it might have that appearance. The behavior of God's people can often confuse unbelievers. At the same time, God's methods often confuse even believers. Who are the believers here? The Israelites. When they're in the very situation, here comes Pharaoh. What are they saying? Why have you done this to us? They don't have a clue what's going on. Obedience supersedes efficiency. They could have gone to the Philistines even though it was near. But God said, no, don't go that way. Obedience, it would have been much more efficient to skip the Red Sea thing for them and to go right by the way of the Philistines, right? What if Israel had gone despite? God said not to go. What if they said, wait, it's right over there. We're just going to march that way. What do you think would have happened?
We've already got another example.
Right. Okay. Now, I've got 2 points here. Expect to be misunderstood. God's methods often confuse unbelievers and believers also. And obedience supersedes efficiency. Let me ask you a question. When you think about the New Testament, just run through real quick. In the New Testament, when people wanted to convert somebody else, what did they do? What? Or how? They preached the gospel. Okay? That's number one. When people in the New Testament wanted to convert somebody, they preached the gospel. Okay? Number two. Right. There's one way in the New Testament to convert somebody. Preach the gospel. That's all we ever see them do. Let me ask you a question. Yes, sir. Right.
What's the next, basically the next thing that happens? Here's water. What hinders me?
Right. Preach. Every time you see somebody converted beforehand, faith comes by. Okay. So let me ask you this question. If somebody comes up to you and says, do you know what I'm going to do this weekend? Me and my church are going to have this person who plays the guitar very well go down in the corner, the square of Watertown, and start singing gospel songs on their guitar to bring them in. And then when we've got a crowd, we're going to start conveying our message to them. Do you ever see that in the New Testament? All they do is they walk places that we drive now, and they start preaching. Okay, my point is that all we see in the New Testament is preaching. We don't see evangelism through singing, you know, getting out your band. One time Marcy and I think when we were visiting Budapest, I forget exactly if we were visiting or actually lived there at the time, we were in this big square. And we walk up, and this guy's jamming away, and he's jamming in English, so I can understand it. And he starts preaching with a translator. And when the music was going, there was a big crowd there. And within 15 minutes, Marcy and I were almost the only ones left. And I was just outside of the circle of his comfort and my comfort, but he saw me, and he thought he had a prospect. But my point is that as long as that music was there, guess who was there? All of them. But when the music stopped, did they want the message? Not at all. We don't see that. Okay. What about, let me ask you a question. Anybody in here ever hear of a missionary society? What is it?
They support and send out missionaries.
It's a society of missionaries. They support and delegate often. Okay. The first one in among churches of Christ. Okay? I hope you understand. I'm not talking about churches of Christ that we see in the New Testament. We'll talk about that in a minute. But since after the Reformation, churches of Christ, the first one, the first president of it said this. This is in 1849. There is now heard from the east and from the west, from the north and from the south, one general, if not universal, call for a more efficient organization of our churches. Experience, than which there is not a more efficient teacher, decides and promulgates that our present cooperative system is comparatively inefficient and inadequate to the experiences of the time, no, exigences of the time, and the cause that we plead. In other words, we've got all these little local churches around here, and you know what he's saying? Can you read that? It's not enough. It's not efficient. And so what do they do? By the way, do you know who this is?
He's saying God's plan doesn't
work.
Is it
Alexander Campbell. Really? Yeah.
Wow.
He was the first president. He's the one that pushed for it.
I would say it to him if he was here saying that today. But you have to be very careful saying that, because that's the way God set it up. So if God set it up that way and you're saying it's inadequate, what are you trying to say about God?
What is the missionary society in the New Testament? Be specific. The local congregation. That's the missionary society of the New Testament. So, we see here God's methods can often confuse believers. He's looking at these local congregations and he's saying, it's not enough. We've got to have something bigger, something better, something overarching. And then he's looking for, we need something more efficient. Just do what God says and that's it. Yeah. Oh my.
Yeah. obedience only supersedes efficiency because our sense of efficiency is wrong. And the things that God accomplishes by doing them the way he does accomplishes so much more than what he's trying to accomplish down here.
Yes. Slow down. What he said is the things that God is trying to accomplish, and now he didn't say this, but I'm going to insert this, are different from what we think about. Like, for example, they would have gone to Philistia, but he wanted to prove something by the Red Sea. If nothing else, he wanted Paul to be able to refer back to it in 1 Corinthians 10. So God is trying to accomplish something much greater than they could have ever imagined.
Basically, the method itself that God sets in place will often lead to things that we're not recognizing when we understand what the goal is for using that method. The missionary society thing, one of the things it's done, let's say it was actually converting thousands of people very quickly. Well, no, the rest of us are learning how to teach that way. And that's something that's accomplished by doing it God's way. And there's some efficiency in doing that, too. We have accomplished something relatively quickly there.
Yes. It takes the money. Not only is it unscriptural, but one thing that it does is it takes the money. Whoever's got money can be involved in evangelism. What about the people who don't have money? That's one thing that happens. Good point. It's not enough to look good. How did Israel come out? It says they came out marching in martial array. They came out of Egypt. Boom, boom, boom. But God didn't let them go up there because he knew when they saw a fight, what would they do? Start running. In other words, they looked the part, but they weren't ready to play the part. Some of us put on a good show, but when it comes time for the rubber to hit the road, guess where we are? Gone. God knew this about them. It fits some Christians also. Comments or questions about what we've talked about?
Didn't have any problem praying the Amalekites.
I was going to say that's the point I was going to bring up. Not much after this. They do run into a fight.
Yeah, and who wins the day for them?
No, I don't know.
Yeah. Yep. Right before the Amalekites, who do they get when they see Egypt? They came walking out in martial array, and here comes Egypt, and what happens to the martial array? Okay, so chapter 16. I'm not really going to talk much about the miracle of providing water. It reestablishes that God is God, and he can do anything, and they should see that once again. Holding them accountable. Chapter 16, the Lord provides manna and quail. But in this chapter is the establishment of what? The Sabbath. I'm not going to read the whole chapter. Verse 4. Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them. If you read the text, You would have read test a lot. You would have had read test over several months, and then you understand from the rest of the Old and New Testament that there were tests over hundreds of years. The point is, one test isn't all there is to pleasing God. This seems to shoot a hole in the theory of what? Once saved, always saved. Now, I'm talking about the Old Testament right now, but it applies in the New Testament also. Okay, I'm going to give you a test. 6 days or 5 days, you get enough for that day. Verse 5, on the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily. This is the first hint at a Sabbath. It actually doesn't mention it right here. It just says, gather twice as much. Well, verse 13, when it came about that quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew evaporated, behold, the surface of the wilderness, there was like a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost on the ground. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, manna. Yeah. They said, what is it? Translated, but the word is the same word for manna. Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man as much as he should eat. You shall take an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. The sons of Israel did so, and some gathered much and some little. When they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat. Sounds like something miraculous is going on there. Moses, so we have miracle on top of miracle. Here comes the manna's bread is falling to the ground, and then when they pick it up, doesn't matter how much they pick it up, they have an omer full. Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it till morning, but they did not listen to Moses, and they failed test number one. It bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them. They gathered it morning by morning, every man as he should, as much as he should eat. But the sun grew hot and it would melt. Now, on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, then he said to them, this is what the Lord meant back there in verse 5. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance. A holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake, and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over, put aside to be kept until morning. So they put it aside until morning, as Moses had ordered, and it did not become foul, nor was there any worm in it. Interesting, all the other days, if you had extra, yeah, okay. Verse 25, Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. Interesting. It's there all the other days, and then on this day's none. Okay. Verse 27. It came about at the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. They fail test number two. By the way, sin never gets you anything. This is a perfect illustration of it. Disobedience doesn't get you anything. Verse 28. The Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you bread for 2 days. On the sixth day, remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. Could you imagine spelling it out any more clearly for them? I have to be careful because I would be right there with them. So the people rested on the seventh day. The house of Israel named it manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like chicken? No. But we often say everything tastes like chicken. Like wafers with honey. Then Moses said, this is what the Lord commanded. Let an omerful be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omerful of manna in it. Place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. And as the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept. The sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years until they came to the inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land. Now an omer is a tenth of an ephah. Okay. Where in the world am I? Not much to say from that, other than to review the Sabbath. Anything from the history that we've seen right here, other than Israel falls and falls and falls over and over and over. The warning is, you who think you stand, be careful lest you fall, right? Okay, facts about the Sabbath. First of all, the Sabbath is instituted here. Did you notice how familiar they were? Oh, we've been doing this for hundreds of years, all the time we've been in. What do they know about the Sabbath in this chapter? Nothing. Verse 23, the Lord said to him, this is what the Lord, Moses said to him, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance. Well, if they already knew that, then he wouldn't have had to tell them that. Okay, so we have it instituted here. This is a good reminder for us. There are some that think the Sabbath goes all the way back to the creation. The Old Testament teaches that it does not go all the way back to the creation. Any verses to support what I've just said? That it's instituted here at this time. Good. I said that some people assert the Sabbath rest as a day for everybody goes all the way back to creation. It's a commandment. They all have to keep it. That's not true. There are passages that show otherwise in the Old Testament.
You look at the passage in the
Old Testament? Not necessarily.
Talk about Moses giving them the Sabbath.
Who did?
Jesus.
Yeah.
Talk about Moses giving them the Sabbath.
Right.
So Moses wasn't there at creation. I don't know where the verse is.
I can't think of it either.
I thought it was in John, but I can do that.
Mm-hmm. There's some in the Old Testament also that say specifically, what's its purpose? Maybe there's a passage that says its purpose. There's one that says it happened in the wilderness. There's two that say it happened in the wilderness. Mindy, you want to?
But with it in Genesis, I've heard that it is an example for us. I'm not saying it necessarily is the argument that the God's example is to rest on the seventh day.
Okay, the question would be, yes, that is different. Exactly, it is different. It is, and the question then is the example necessarily binding on us? So yeah, it may be an example. It may be an example. If it is an example, is it necessarily binding on us? God rested, so we must. It that's not shown anywhere in the Old or New Testament.
I mean, if it was, then why aren't we following his example on all the things he did in 6 days?
Yeah.
Is there any chance that could have just been that foreshadowing towards the Sabbath?
Well, there's not a chance. I'm not picking on you. There's not a chance. That's exactly what it was. Exodus 31. Oh, I'm sorry. actually, that's the passage that says it's a sign. It's Exodus 20 that says, 6 days you shall labor, do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath day of the Lord God. You shall not do any work on it, so on and so forth. Verse 11, for in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Yes. So it is foreshadowing. That what the Lord did in creation is foreshadowing it. Exodus 31 gives us that it's a sign. It's for verse 31, verse 12. This is a sign between me and you, Israel. So if it's a sign between Israel and God, then how in the world could everybody do it and it still be a sign for just God and Israel? Let me just throw up these two more passages real quick. Nehemiah 9 and Exodus Ezekiel 20 both explicitly state, you gave it to them at Mount Sinai in the wilderness. Okay? George, can you turn to Nehemiah 9 and read that in just a minute?
I have experienced the seventh day of venison in the past, and simply talking about the Sabbath. I never quite know what to say when they say, well, then God probably about the Ten Commandments, they always bring up that it's remember the Sabbath day was don't forget it,
Yes, the Jews could not forget. Oh, I see. As though it's speaking to the past.
Right.
But not necessarily, I'm not ready to support this with something else. Maybe something somebody else says it on the top of their head. But remember can refer to the future. In fact, I think if you read the Passover, it might say it in the Passover. But the point is that remember doesn't necessarily, yes, Exodus 13, verse 3. Remember this day in which you went out from Egypt. But it's actually speaking of what's going to happen in the future. I don't remember them doing the Passover. Okay. But still, that would be, that's the old, again, it's another, we've just transitioned topics. Well, my point is that remember does not necessarily mean something happened in the past. It can be a proleptic command. In other words, it spoke. In fact, that's what in Genesis chapter 2, then the Lord sanctified the Sabbath because in it he rested. Okay, that does the wording, the grammar doesn't necessarily mean that the Lord actually did it then. Moses could be inserting it there, knowing that it would happen 1,000 years later, or however much later, in Exodus 13, 14, 15, 16. Like, let me give a better example. When did Judas kill or betray Jesus? Right. How many times in the Gospels do you read Judas who betrayed Jesus? Many times. Right, exactly. So in other words, they're saying it before it actually happened. That's called prolepsis. I'm sorry to throw out that big fancy word, but they have a limited vocabulary. That's what happens. Go with what you know. A small brain, really. Okay. And Deuteronomy 5:15 says, it's a sign to remember their deliverance from Egypt. If it was for everybody, always, then it wouldn't make any sense for it to be for Israel to remember their deliverance from Egypt. That's okay. That's okay. We can talk. Yeah. Did you get something out of that?
Yeah,
okay. We can work on it later. You want to say something?
Very briefly, could you remind me why perpetual doesn't mean perpetual in Exodus 31?
Sure.
Where did it go? Perpetual covenant, in verse 16. 31:16, they'll observe the Sabbath, this other Sabbath. Okay, well, my first question, should genuine, bona fide Israelites be celebrating the Passover still, or the Sabbath still?
If they're going to be consistent, yes.
Okay, so why is it not? You had a fantastic pithy argument one time about...
that's gone.
never mind then, but I remember something about it at one time. I was just kind of hoping it was right there in front of me.
Okay.
Because that's what I worry about most of all when I run across stuff like this. Look, it says perpetual. Yeah, it does. Now, I know I'd be inconsistent, but there's other times where it doesn't always say perpetual with other commandments.
Okay.
I got a sub-note that goes back to this 29:9. It talks about the perpetual priesthood for Aaron.
Excellent. Look up anything that says perpetual in the Old Testament. The perpetual priesthood. Was the perpetual priesthood to last forever?
No.
But it says perpetual.
Perpetual.
For them. And it's also, what was their perpetualness based on?
Obedience.
So it's conditional. If I tell...
You're to keep this for all your generations forever. I mean, over and over and over, you read this idea, over and over and over. What happened when they went to Babylonian captivity? They
didn't
keep none of that stuff. Why? Because they were obedient.
Yeah, I'm going to shoot myself in the foot. I'm looking for it right here. I always go to the land and I can't see it right now.
In this situation, yes, I agree
with you. Right now I'm unprepared, but it's any look up any word perpetual, like Ryan said, the priesthood, and it's based on conditions. If I said to you, I'm going to be at a church on Sunday, does that mean I absolutely, there's no way I'm not going to miss ever church on Sunday? No. It's always implied certain conditions will exist. You know, I'm going to come to church on Sunday if I still have my head on my shoulders. You know? Okay. All right. Now, yes? Oh, sorry, Mindy?
I've heard it said that this was the Jewish people, but the Christian Sabbath is in the
Yeah.
People will say that it's true.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I know what you're saying.
Okay, I was going to say this for the Ten Commandments, but that's fine. Okay, yes, the Christian Sabbath. Let me ask this question first of all. What was all of this stuff that we're talking about now? All of the rules and regulations and law for Israel had a primary and a secondary or plenary purpose. It was for them, it was so that they understood, you learn and you obey everything I say to you. When I say jump, you jump. For us, what are all those laws?
A tutor, a type.
They talk about Christ and all of these ceremonial, not all of them, I'm not saying absolutely, but let me overstate the case for a moment. All the laws, they were a type. That's what we see in the book of Hebrews primarily. It's a type. The temple, yes, it was for them and for their worship, but it was actually a type, actually at the same time, a type. Now, having said that, of what is the Sabbath rest a type? Heaven. Hebrews chapter 4 says it. I mean, we don't have to worry about this. We don't have to guess. God tells us. The Sabbath. The beginning of the context is in chapter 3, verse 7. The warning is, you better be faithful. Why? Verse 7. Just as the Holy Spirit said to David when the Psalms were written, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as when they provoked me in the day of trial in the wilderness. Verse 11, as I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest. Here's your Sabbath, okay? So he told the Israelites not to mess up because they won't be able to get into the land. They had already been partaking of the Sabbath. Here he refers the Sabbath to the promised land. But when they're in the promised land, he says to David, be careful or you won't be able to get into my rest. Well, David, number one, is already observing the Sabbath. Number two, he's already in the promised land. So how is it that he cannot get into God's rest? Well, the answer of it is, we'll just skip to the end. Chapter 4, verse 9. Yes. There remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For the one who has entered his rest, has he himself rested from his good works. Okay. So the Sabbath, and you have to read the context in between there, but the Sabbath of the Old Testament is a type of heaven. Because guess what? While we're here on the earth, what are we supposed to be doing?
Working.
And who agrees it's work? I do. Yes, it's joyful and it's wonderful. But like Paul said, look, I'm ready to die. If I stay here, I get to do more, but I'm ready to die at the same time, and it's going to be rest. That's ultimately what it prefigures. So, in the New Testament, you cannot prove that the Sabbath is now Sunday, if you will. What you can prove is the Sabbath is heaven. That was fun. Sure. Yeah, they did a lot, really, that we do. In fact, a lot of our worship comes right from the Jewish synagogue system. So yes, but that doesn't mean everything. Everything came. The Sabbath, the mandatory rest period, we don't see it in the New Testament. Anything else on that? Okay. Let's go to the Amalekites. Because this is big for Israel, that's why. Verse 8 of chapter 17. Amalek came and fought against Israel. The first people to fight against Israel. Egypt came and tried to fight, but God beat them up. These are the first people to actually fight against Israel. They're distant relatives. So you've got relatives picking on them. And other passages say that the Amalekites came up on Israel from behind and started picking off the people from behind. So they're cousins beating up on cousins. They're doing it in an ugly way, and they're picking on God's people. So Moses said to Joshua, first time Joshua is mentioned, choose men for us and go out and fight against Amalek. Tomorrow I will station myself on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. Joshua did as Moses told him and fought against Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. So it came about when Moses held his hand up that Israel prevailed. And when he let his hand down, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands were heavy. Then they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other side. Thus his hands were steady until the sun set. So Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Who won the fight? God. In fact, it'll go on to say God. But you can. So we have Joshua doing his work, Moses doing his work, Israel doing their work, but at the same time, God is doing his work. Okay, I wasn't going to ask that. Yeah.
Does they deserve what happened?
Oh, yeah, they deserve it, yes. First of all, if for no other reason than they're picking on God's people, let me get back to my notes, and I can tell you why they deserve what they get. Oh, boy, oh, boy. That discussion on the Sabbath really threw me off.
But the
I don't need that.
Genesis 36:12.
Yes. Grandson of Esau. They attacked from behind, Deuteronomy 25. And they were the Numbers 24 says it was the first nation, so they're setting a precedent. If God lets them beat up Israel, guess what? Everybody will do. So there are really three reasons, and this is a protracted overcoming them. Right? He says that he is going. Verse 14. Write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Moses built an altar and named it, "The Lord is my banner." And he said, "The Lord has sworn, the Lord will have war against Amalek from generation to generation." Yes, because Amalek came out and picked on Israel. Okay.
I was just saying, notice that it says the Lord will have war with this. The Lord fights the battles for Israel.
Yes, and it's a book of memorial. When, a couple things about this. Number one, when God finally wins, number one, God has the power. He said he would. Number two, God keeps his word. Number three, when God finally wins, although he'll go on to say he's going to use them, when God finally wins, they got to give God the glory for it because he's the one actually causing the victory.
And I was wondering what was with the hands. That's the posture of prayer, kind of the universal posture. It seems kind of a superstitious thing. When he says, as long as Moses' hands were up, we were waiting. When his hands came down, we started waiting. And yet, but we see that as the prayerful stance.
Yes, very true. At the same time, even if I didn't know anything about prayer, I know that from the context, it's not superstitious. I know you agree with me there. Right. He's got that staff. As long as he's got that staff up, you know, that's what we're saying. God sometimes works in ways that we just don't have a clue what it's about. All we know is this is what he did.
Well, I think the people at that point, if they realize every single time they go to Moses and Aaron,
always complaining to him. So they're looking towards him, and I think that that kind of reinforces the bond that would go with what Moses is going with, because, you know,
when he called the hail in front of Pharaoh, he raised his arms to the sky, and Pharaoh saw that and said, oh, this man's got power. Saying, that's the point you're making about Israel. Yeah, they're seeing. In fact, they will, like you say, they always come to Moses, and in chapter 17, verse 7, they had come to Moses, but they tested the Lord. You know, so they're coming to Moses, but like your point is, yeah, that would be a visible manifestation. Yeah, God's behind this, what's going on here. Couple expectations, expect difficulties, expect help, but expect victory, but only through perseverance. That's what they learned there. And we need to remember what God remembers. God said, look, write this in a book. This book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua. Time to sit down and listen to what happened the other day and do it again and again. Number one, we're just like Israel. As much as it's easy to pick on Israel, we're just like Israel. We're all human. Christ's death, we're supposed to, God says, remember Christ's death. We're supposed to remember our sins. He who says he does not have sin is a liar. Yeah, we're supposed to remember our sins. Our good works, God remembers our good works. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 10. In fact, let's turn there. The reason I'm turning there is because this world, our religious world, de-emphasizes works. I'm not trying to overemphasize works, but I'm trying to bring them back up to, hey, yes, there's grace, but grace is conditioned on works. Hebrews chapter 6. He said, look, I want to tell you more about Melchizedek, but you can't understand it because you're not mature enough. I will tell you about him if God permits it, but God might not, because people who backslide, God sometimes doesn't forgive. He probably will forgive you, we think. Why? Verse 10, for God is not so unjust as to forget your work and the love that you have shown towards his name. So we are to remember our works. God does. Remember the poor. And we could go on. Comments or questions on this section? Okay. Yeah, this will be all right. This will be good. We can handle this. By the way, here are my notes for the Sabbath right here on the back page where I said if I get a question about the Sabbath, I'll just flip my paper over. And I forgot that. Okay. We're going to skip the questions because George said that they were difficult.
You asked too many that I had long answers.
Sorry.
In my room.
Well, that's not why. We're skipping them because we have 2 minutes. But we can... Okay, Exodus 18, all right? In Exodus 18, they arrive somewhere in the mountain range that Mount Sinai is. Look in verse 5. Jethro comes with his wife to Moses in the wilderness where he was camped at the Mount of God. So he's actually arrived in the vicinity. Whether or not he's actually at Sinai, in chapter 19, it looks like he goes a little further to Sinai. But they're in the vicinity of the mountain of God. Okay, verse 1. Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, how the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. Verse 10. So Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of Pharaoh who delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that Jehovah is greater than all the gods. Indeed, it was proven when they dealt proudly against the people. A couple things about this. I don't need to belabor this point because we've made it over and over even today. Number one, God's way works. He had said, when I beat up the Egyptians, all the world will know I'm Jehovah. Up until this day, to Jethro, Jehovah was just another god among gods. Maybe equal, maybe not, but now he knows Jehovah is God. I know you want to say something, Gary. I can see it on here.
Well, he's a priest of God. He believes in God.
Yes.
Obviously.
Yes.
Obviously, he has some question whether there are some smaller gods or not. But I kind of take the idea that he believes that God is the God over over the others, in a sense.
Now I know that the Lord is greater than all the gods.
Before, maybe he just took it as a hunch.
I don't know what happened before. All I know is that now he knows. Because it was proven when. Okay, so maybe I overstated the case that... Okay, I said that before today, according to Jethro, God was just another god among gods. All right, maybe I over or understated the case. Now Jethro understands that God is greater than all the other gods. But it still remains, actually, whether or not... In fact, it seems to imply Jethro still doesn't understand who Jehovah is. He's the only God. And Jethro didn't quite say that. He's greater than all the other gods. He didn't say he's the only God. He said he's greater than the other gods. So, maybe I overstated it. Thank you for that correction. God's ways work. You want to say more?
I do. It's about the mountain.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
This is the same mountain that God appeared to Moses on, right?
Yeah.
This is in the land of Midian, right? So it's a chance here. There's a possibility that it's not on Mount Sinai.
Oh.
It's in the land of Midian, which would be further down the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. It's just something.
Yeah. Why do you say that, actually, as much as I was shaking my head a second ago?
Well, when you look where Midian's territory was, and pull your map back up. The map you have.
Yeah, but why do you say it was in Midian?
Well, that's because that's where it was. In Exodus 3.
Oh, my map's in another place.
Yeah. That's all.
Okay. All right, I'll look at it.
Yeah. There's some thought that it's actually further down.
Okay, interesting. Not sure why they would both be called the Mountain of God then. The Mountain of God. I mean, I know you could. So God has a lot of mountains. Okay. Let's close with this point, I guess. If God's ways work, then why do Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, atheists, etc. still exist? We've answered this before. It's review.
John 3:19.
Which says?
That light is coming to the world, but men prefer darkness because of the
deep. Right. They prefer darkness. Exactly. It's not a question of evidence. God has proved himself over and over and over. Romans 1 is the passage I turned to, but we've turned there. Why do they still exist? Because they want to. Overall, they want to. Some of them might not have had time yet, but generally speaking, they have had time to. If you are seeking the Lord, God put us here to seek him, Acts 17. If you are seeking him, Matthew 7, you will find him, Matthew 6, you will find him. So the question isn't, you know, and he's put the evidence out there, Romans 1 again. Yes, sir.
Well, I was just going to say that over the years, Christians have not made a particularly factual argument.
That's right. There's a saying attributed to Mahatma Gandhi, although he probably didn't say it, is, I love your Christ, but not your Christians.
Christianity is great. They should try it sometime.
Yeah. Okay, we'll stop there. Any other comments or questions? Thank you.